You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of May, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, ABC's London correspondent Jeffrey Kaufman will be setting the day's agenda from tax evasion to gay marriage.
We head to Liberia to find out why there's a news blackout in force on the country's Nobel Prize winning president.
And... as Europe's pop princes and princesses head back home across the continent, we'll be reliving the drama of Saturday's Eurovision Song Contest final in Malmö.
Plus, we'll look at the battle brewing between two of South Africa's biggest cities as Durban and Cape Town vie to become the premier location for the country's burgeoning film industry.
Johannesburg is quite popular as well, particularly for kind of inner city, deconstructed, urbanized environments. The city's got a very nice edge to it.
All that, plus we play some music too, probably Eurovision inspired. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The leader of Pakistan's opposition PTI party, the former cricketer Imran Khan, has accused a political rival of being responsible for the killing of the party's vice president Zara Shahid Hussain. She was shot dead outside her home in Karachi on Saturday. Imran Khan says Altaf Hussain, leader of the MQM party, who's in self-imposed exile in London, openly threatened PTI workers and leaders through public broadcast. Imran Khan also blamed the British government, saying he'd warned them about Mr. Hussain. MQM are demanding that he retracts his comments. Mohamed Anwar is the MQM's head of international relations and human rights affairs.
We all know that he has nothing to do with this. Mr. Hussain is London. How could he be behind murder? So it's utter nonsense. It's a madman's cry. A man who is lost, frustrated, in utter frustration, does not know where he is now. The would-be, he thought that he was the Prime Minister. Mia Nawaz Sharif is now going to be the Prime Minister.
The Chief of Staff to the Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, has resigned in a scandal over expenses. Nigel Wright stood down after it emerged that he'd secretly given a $90,000 cheque to a senator to help repay housing expenses which had been claimed improperly. In a statement, he said he regretted the impact the matter had had on the government and his colleagues. The senator in question, Mike Duffy, resigned from the Conservative caucus on Thursday, 2 days after details of the cheque came to light. Stephen Harper said he accepted Mr. Wright's resignation with great regret. Militants have killed at least 10 Iraqi policemen in a series of attacks on checkpoints in the west of the country. 7 policemen were killed when militants attacked checkpoints and patrols near the western town of Haditha, 190 kilometres northwest of Baghdad. In Rawa, 260 kilometres northwest of the capital, gunmen attacked police checkpoints, the house of a member of the provincial council and a police chief's residence, killing 3 policemen and wounding 2 others. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility for the attacks. The number of bodies recovered from a collapsed tunnel in an Indonesian copper mine has risen to 14. 14 more people are still missing, but the owners, Freeport McMoRan Copper and Gold, says rock falls are hampering rescue efforts and hopes of finding any survivors of last Tuesday's collapse are fading. Richard Atkinson is the company's CEO.
We want to provide support. We want our people here that are working now to be safe because it's a dangerous situation. And they're doing that. And we are going to respond to this. And we're going to do everything we can do to make sure this never happens again.
A huge tornado about a kilometre wide has destroyed a number of houses in a town near Oklahoma City. The Twister is part of an extreme weather system moving through the central United States and stretching from North Texas to Minnesota. Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Nebraska are all in the path of the storm system, which could produce up to 80-mile-an-hour winds, baseball-sized hail, and violent tornadoes in some areas. The storm is so large and severe that it prompted an unusually blunt warning from the National Weather Service. You could be killed if not underground or in a tornado shelter. Ryanair has posted record full-year earnings, but it's warning that profit growth will slow sharply in the coming 12 months on demand weakness in the European Union and high fuel and airport costs. Europe's largest budget airline reported net profit of €569 million for the 12 months to the end of March. That's up 13% and ahead of an average analyst forecast of €558 million in a company poll. But Ryanair says it expects profit for the coming financial year to be at most €600 million, an increase of 5%, and it could come in flat at €570 million. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. We will be back with Barney in about 25 minutes with another check of the world news headlines. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Joining us now in the studio is Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News. Jeffrey, thanks very much for joining us here in the studio.
Good Monday morning.
Good Monday morning. Pleasure to see you as always. Let's start, though, about a very hot topic, it seems, at the moment, tax havens.
This is a good one. This is a really interesting story. You know, it depends where you sit on the political spectrum, what you think about business. Either the tax laws in the UK and many other Western countries, well, actually many countries in general, have been eclipsed by the internet, or you think that these big companies that like Google and Amazon are just nefarious cheats who have found with their high-priced accountants and lawyers ways to make us live one way and they live another by avoiding taxes and charging their taxes. Here in the UK, of course, Google, Amazon, and many other countries, Starbucks companies, under scrutiny because they are based in Luxembourg at 1.5% corporate tax or in Ireland at 12.5% corporate tax. Google and Amazon, $3-4 billion in sales last year and paying a couple of million in taxes here. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, slated to meet with Prime Minister David Cameron today.
Yes, and David Cameron has stressed, though, that they need to get their own houses in order before they push for any international action.
Well, the issue here really is that we are in such a globalized world, it's very hard for any country now to act unilaterally. But, you know, Cameron is, we're going to talk quite a lot about Cameron, because Cameron's really not having a good time of it today and this week, in fact, this month and maybe this year. But Cameron is being squeezed on the left by Britain's Labour leader, Ed Miliband, who has said, listen, if other countries can't be coordinated to act, we will do it on our own as a Labour government should we gain power. This is a very popular issue. People are really offended. Google and Amazon, you know, these internet companies kind of like to present themselves as big, lovable, leftist teddy bears that treat everybody well. What is it, Google, that has a motto of do no evil? And yet last week before a House of Commons committee here in London, one of the Tory members said, you know, you are evil. You are not paying taxes. You're not pulling your weight. You're avoiding this whole ruse of we aren't really based in London or in England. It's just there's just no evidence. You know, the papers this weekend were filled with testimonies from former Google and Amazon employees saying, oh, come on, we do all of our sales in London. The contracts are signed here in the UK. It's just a computer that makes it sound like it's in Ireland or Luxembourg.
And Cameron wrote this letter, is also trying trying to go to these tax havens, the Grand Cayman Islands, Bermuda, asking them for reforms, asking them to change things. But how likely is that actually going to happen?
Well, the U.S. is pushing very hard. I think one of the interesting things about the U.K. is that I believe that the statistic is that a third of the world's tax havens are actually U.K. protectorates and territories. So Cameron actually does have some say in some of these things. There is a lot of pressure now internationally, and part of the transparency push around the world is to make these tax havens a lot less secretive and a lot more transparent in who's putting money in and where people are hiding them. But, you know, ultimately, that's a slightly different story, the tax haven versus tax dodging by these big globalized companies that say, you buy a book through Amazon UK and it's £9. You buy it on the street here, it's £12. And Amazon can do that because they're not paying corporate tax here. Well, what's happened, in this morning's paper, we're seeing a story of more and more high street, main street stores here in the UK closing. There's a direct line. You don't have to be an abstract thinker to understand why we are seeing the closing of mom and pop stores and books, not just bookstores, but in clothing stores, etc. When these companies are able to, through efficiencies, but also through tax evasion, offer much lower prices to consumers.
And as you said earlier, he faces, David Cameron, a tough week ahead because, of course, we've got the gay marriage bill back in the House of Commons. This happens amidst a backdrop of a wave of move towards same-sex legislation across Europe, now in 14 countries, yet lots of sticking points.
I think
points.
It's 15, actually.
15,
as a, yeah, I think France last week made it 15.
15,
but,
yeah.
But you know, I don't blame you. I have trouble keeping track. I actually counted before I came in because it is so confusing. But, you know, Cameron is being pulled. To be David Cameron this week. He is being pulled in two directions, and it seems that he can't win. He's trying to be a progressive conservative by appealing to younger voters, understanding this tidal wave of tolerance that is sweeping the Western world, and yet, you know, his party has a very conservative base that is offended by this, and he is being nipped from the right by the UK Independence Party, which wants to sever ties with Europe, get out of the European Union, and he is trying to. It's an impossible juggling act, and gay marriage is really now a flashpoint on that.
Why is he taking such a stand on this issue?
You know, I wonder that too. I think my sense is that he's trying to modernize his party, that if he doesn't do it, then he allows Labour and the Liberal Democrats here in this country to own the issues of tolerance, modernity, that appeal to younger voters. It was a big risk, and maybe he will or is regretting it because he didn't have to move ahead. There are already civil partnerships for gay couples here in this country. But having opened that Pandora's box, it's done. Now there are efforts to derail it, water it down. But he doesn't have a majority, and he's now said that his members can vote according to their conscience. The Liberal Democrats and Labour and enough conservatives will support this, that it should pass. Although there's some manipulating going on that makes this one worth watching.
And it comes now, really, you saw the 30 different MPs that were rebelling against him in an open letter. And you see there's a political risk there with Europe as well. He's facing a lot of opposition to some key policies in his party that could affect his future standing in the party.
You do wonder what his future standing is. But let me just say on this issue that there are two other points today. The Boy Scouts of America today are looking at the issue of lifting a 100-year ban on gay members. This is just one of those holdouts, again, you know, cultural conservatism facing the 21st century. And then in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, really, really ugly incident over the weekend, a gay rights demonstration. Thousands upon thousands of people descended on a small group, including priests of the Russian Orthodox Church, who are seen apparently in videos, according to the papers, attacking some of these people themselves. Really disturbing, but it shows you the cultural gulf we're facing on issues like this today, this issue in particular.
So Prime Minister Cameron, having a bit of a tough week ahead, perhaps. President Obama had probably a tougher week with his mire of scandals and controversies. But some good news, well, so maybe some happy news. He met up with Burma's president over the weekend.
This is an interesting story, and yes, it's a tough time to be a world leader, isn't it? Sen Ten is it the president of Burma? After 50 years of isolation, Burma coming in from the cold, Hillary Clinton, as you may remember, helped the U.S. normalize relations with Burma. This is just an interesting little footnote here. Burma was one of the last rogue states. I guess North Korea really owns that mantle right now. For 47 years, was completely isolated from most of the world. And really because of the remarkable work of Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel laureate, who just simply would not give in, Burma finally has opened up. And Obama meeting with the president of Burma is significant. There are two currents here that are interesting, though. Some say it's premature. Some say this is right. There's a lot of ethnic violence, particularly against the Muslim minorities in Burma, and so he's been criticized. But the argument is, listen, you've got to give the president of Burma evidence that opening up and open and being tolerant has dividends, and so the meeting with Obama does that. Whereas others are saying maybe it's premature, but it is a sign of changing times.
Jeffrey, just one really, really quick question: your prediction? Do you think Aung San Suu Kyi will be president?
Ooh, you know, I'm not so schooled in the micro politics of Burma, but I guess my sense would be that we might have seen that. But I don't know. It's an interesting thought. I guess like Nelson Mandela, it's certainly for those of us on the outside, it's a delicious prospect. But
wait and see.
Yeah, tough prediction to make. Jeffrey, thank you very much for setting the agenda for us here on Midori House.
A pleasure.
That was Jeffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent.
And in a moment, we'll be finding out why the press are boycotting Liberia's Nobel Prize-winning president.
The Menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we visit Italy's Slow Fish Trade Fair for new innovative ways of serving fish. Santiago pops into this Midori House Studio One with his basket for the last time. And we visit a restaurant in Istanbul that works hard to uncover Turkey's forgotten food treasures.
In Turkey, you really are your own chef. And the whole principle of meze, these little hors d'oeuvres, is that you make your own plate. You know, you take a little bit of olive oil, and you take something spicy, and you take something salty, and you take something sweet. In a way, it leaves it up to the diner to be the inventive one.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Now, leaf through one of Liberia's newspapers today and you might notice something missing. Any mention whatsoever of the country's president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The press in Liberia began its boycott of the president last week in response to her refusal to distance herself from remarks made by her chief bodyguard that suggested journalists would be persecuted should they scrutinise the president too deeply.
The remarks caused outrage among the country's journalists, who have long regarded President Johnson Sirleaf, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010, as a champion of the free press. Well, to discuss the boycott and its potential impact on the Liberian leader, we're joined now by James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James, thanks very much for joining us here in the studio. Let's just look at those comments. Be careful questioning the integrity of Liberians. Be careful because you have your pens, and if you incriminate the character and integrity of Liberians like myself, we will come after you. Some quite strong comments made there by Mr. Warwick. Why was it so surprising then that President Johnson Sirleaf didn't come out against those comments?
And then he went on to say, you have your pens and we have our guns. I mean, it was pretty strong stuff. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has this is not the first time that she's closed ranks behind some of her supporters or key people when criticised. She was criticised for appointing several members of her family to key posts beforehand, and she came out to defend them. She doesn't want that. She has an interesting relationship with scrutiny in that she has brought it on herself beforehand willingly, and now when it has come to bear, she has reacted pretty defensively.
And Liberia has a pretty poor track record in terms of its relationship with the press, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it's got a pretty troubled history, and obviously the press were targeted significantly in the civil war by different sides. But this still goes on. Even just a couple of days ago, two journalists and their trainer from the Journalists for Human Rights organisation, which is Canadian, were arrested for investigating some arrests in one particular county in the country.
Well, James, do stay with us. More from you soon, because Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, as we mentioned, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011 and has been feted internationally for her work in furthering women's rights, among other things. So how do leaders who receive adulation from abroad bridge the divide between the grind of domestic politics and their status as global figures?
In a moment, we'll hear from Monocle's Washington correspondent on the impact of President Obama's Nobel Prize winning win, which came less than a year into his first term in office. But first, we spoke to Gwen Robertson, who assesses Aung San Suu Kyi's return to domestic politics and its impact, if any, on her reputation abroad.
Since Aung San Suu Kyi was released from nearly 15 years under house arrest in 2010, everyone has remarked on her extraordinary transformation from a pro-democracy icon who stood up to the military, urged sanctions on her country, to this consummate politician who's now in parliament, running her head of her own party, and has made it very clear that she wants a good shot at the presidency in elections at the end of 2015. So there's a contradiction going on with various views of Aung San Suu Kyi as the pro-democracy icon who has in some ways sold out, say, critics by cozying up to the military, and also in particular this year she's had a lot of criticism for not speaking out against the bouts of shocking violence against Muslims, for example, in central Myanmar, and last year very vicious unrest in western Rakhine State against Muslim Rohingya. In Parliament, she has seized for herself the chairmanship of a rule of law committee and seems to be very busy doing activities related to that, and she's going overseas and she's changed her tune quite a lot on her country. Instead of urging trade boycotts, she's now calling for foreign investment. That's another huge change. But I think the biggest change, and particularly in the context of her Nobel Peace Prize, what astonishes critics, I think, is how much she has courted the military in this country, to the extent where there was a seminal moment earlier this year where she attended for the first time the annual Armed Forces Day parade, sat with the generals, some of them being people involved probably in her detention for many years before that. So I would say it's interesting that for all her followers who feel disillusioned that she's courting the military, if they really want her to lead the country, these people will really have to accept that if they want her to lead, she's going to have to make these fairly unsavoury deals and make deals horse trade, just like any other ordinary politician.
No man is a prophet in his own country, and I think that when Obama was named winner of the Nobel Peace Prize barely 9 months into his first term, people in the United States saw it as the best illustration yet of this great gap between the fact that he had come back down to earth in the United States and that whatever magic he had as a candidate had disappeared as he had to engage with this dirty world of governing and the sort of messiness of Washington, but yet remain this almost magical figure in other parts of the world. And he still remains in many parts of the world a more mythical figure because people don't see all the complexities of what he does day to day, and I think have a purer sense of his place in American politics. There is obviously a disappointment that's come in around the world, and you know, he made a point when he gave a speech in Oslo to make a sort of defensive of war in some cases, and I think as the world grapples with Obama, much like the American left, it's coming to terms with the fact that, you know, here's a guy who has been happy to use drone warfare, has kept Guantanamo open, has at moments escalated the war in Afghanistan and engaged the United States in conflicts in Libya and may yet do so again in Syria. And so I think that the Nobel Committee probably in history will grapple with the fact that the guy that they gave an award to is not a great peacemaker, and I think people around the world who saw Obama as the total opposite of Bush will find that he was a more complicated figure there too, and I think Americans still don't entirely know what they think of Barack Obama, and all these sort of scandals that have emerged in the last week complicate it further, but I think we've known for a while that he's really not the caricature that either the extreme left or extreme right imagined he was in 2008 or the citizens of the rest of the world thought he was when he went to Oslo.
That was Monocle's Sasha Eisenberg in Washington at DC. And if we return briefly to you, James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Express, Obama, of course, joining the ranks of Yasser Arafat, Henry Kissinger, these controversial prize winners. In Liberia, do you think there's a disconnect between Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's reputation at home and the way she's perceived from abroad?
Very much so, and the disconnect is getting larger, the gulf is getting larger. She is still increasingly feted abroad. She's part of the Post-Millennium Development Goal UN programme. She's part of the high-level panel with the president from Indonesia and David Cameron, the British Prime Minister. And she is still seen as a very important global stateswoman, at least from the perspective of African states. But domestically, she is coming under far more scrutiny, much more criticism. A recent government audit of the 68 resource contracts, which have been awarded since 2009, found that all but two breached Liberia's own laws. And she won the Nobel Prize with Lema Bowie, who was another anti-war campaigner in Liberia, who has broken with the president in the last year and become a strong critic. And importantly, was very, very critical of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's silence over the attacks on the media.
So you talk about that divide between domestic politics, her view domestically versus internationally. Do Liberians take note, though, of the way she's viewed abroad? Do they take that into their thinking of how they perceive her?
Yes, I think they do, and to some extent, I think it's a mark of pride. I mean, it's noteworthy that this last week she has been in America, and so part of the media blackout on her has been it's the withdrawing of reporters from the executive mansion rather than, so she's been away, so there's been less to report. But yes, I think it is important that for Liberians that she is involved on a continental and a global scale and is viewed well.
So just some of her comments, she said, "I'm enjoying this benign neglect. I wish they will continue it for a long time." How do you think the situation is going to resolve itself?
Well, the situation, the House of Representatives is starting to take it into their own hands. There have been a couple of representatives who tried to call her bodyguard to sort of explain himself. And there are going to be these kind of attempts to negotiate. So he'll withdraw some of his comments or say he regrets the way in which he said them or something a bit like that.
Well, James Schneider, from editor, of course, of Think Africa Express, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Time now for a song. This is Julia by The Very Best from the EP The Warm Heart of Africa. And that was The Very Best with Julia. In a moment, we'll be joined by Eurovision fanatic Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who I think is still recovering from Saturday's final. But before all that, it is time for the latest world news headlines. Here's Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Phil. The leader of Pakistan's opposition PTI party, the former cricketer Imran Khan, has accused a political rival of being responsible for the killing of the party's vice president Zara Shahid Hussain on Saturday. He says Altaf Hussain, leader of the MQM party, who's in self-imposed exile in London, openly threatened PTI workers and leaders through public broadcasts. The chief of staff to the Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper has resigned in a scandal over expenses. Mr. Harper said he accepted Nigel Wright's resignation with great regret. 8 car bombs in the mainly Shiite district of Baghdad have killed at least 20 people. In southern Iraq, in Basra, 2 bombs have killed at least 11 people. The number of bodies recovered from a collapsed tunnel in an Indonesian copper mine has risen to 14. 14 more people are still missing, but the owners say hopes of finding any survivors of last Tuesday's collapse are fading. A huge tornado, about a kilometre wide, has destroyed a number of houses in a town near Oklahoma City. It's part of an extreme weather system moving through the central US and stretching from North Texas to Minnesota. Europe's largest budget airline, Ryanair, has reported record net profit of €569 million for the 12 months to the end of March, up 13% on the previous 12 months. But it's warning that profit growth will slow sharply in the coming 12 months. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 10:32. If you are in Istanbul, it's 8:32 here in London. Now, Sweden may still be sweeping up the sequence from Saturday night's Eurovision grand finale, but the party is still well underway, probably in Copenhagen, as the country celebrates its first victory in the annual song contest in 13 years.
Well, Monocle's resident Eurovision expert, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, was there and joins us live in the studio now. Welcome back.
Hello, Cordelia. Hello, Phil. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Now, I've got to admit, I actually watched the entire finale on Saturday at a Eurovision viewing party.
Wasn't it great? Wasn't it great, Phil?
There were moments when I thought I wouldn't be able to take any more of it. But there were some highlights. And of course, your prediction before the final was that you thought Emily DeForest would come away with the win. And yes, indeed, she did.
She did. And you know, I was not very excited with the song. But I have to tell you, Phil, I went to an after party where Emily DeForest sang again the song. And actually, I was humming to the song. I was kind of singing only 3 teardrops. I like the part when she's a bit like Shakira. I just don't like the beginning that much. I mean, it was not my favorite song. My favorite, as you know, is the Norwegian entry, which ended up in 4th place, which is not bad, you know, but...
It wasn't so much of an extravagant performance as you sometimes expect from Eurovision. They seem to be playing it quite safe, Denmark, with that.
Yeah, and actually, I have to tell you, I think most of the contestants, I was reading that, because now every country has to pay for their own entries and the whole performance. Because of the crisis, they didn't use like this megalomaniac. I mean, there were a disco ball here and there, you know, but, most of them was quite... simple performances, I have to say. And even Emily DeForest, she doesn't wear shoes, you know, she has kind of this hippie style, and maybe that's what people want when we're in a crisis.
Well, Emily DeForest from Denmark came away as the winner. Let's have a quick listen to just a bit of that song, shall we?
Such a shame. How many times can we win and lose? How many times can we break the rules between us? Only teardrops. How many times do we have to fight? How many times did we get it right between us? Only teardrops. So come and face me now. Here on this stage tonight, let's leave the past behind us. Eye for an eye, why tear each other apart? Please tell me why. Why do we make it so? I look at us now, we only got ourselves to blame. It's such a shame. Tell me how many times can we win and lose?
Yeah, well, you can definitely hear a hint of Shakira there in her
Absolutely.
Voice.
Absolutely. I can listen to Whenever or Ever right there.
And now, of course, she's been thrust into the limelight. What sort of attention did she receive there?
Oh, actually, it was quite funny because I was at the press conference. And I have to tell you, it's so funny the questions journalists ask. One of them asked, are you happy? I was imagining she was saying, no, I'm extremely depressed. Actually, I have to cancel this press conference. And the other question is, do you have any Russian blood in you? And I did some research. She doesn't. I mean, if she had, maybe her father was Russian or something. But she does. She didn't, you know. But and she was like, no. And it was really interesting.
Fernando, during the final, the one question I think a lot of people were asking was, you know, what's the big deal coming away as the Eurovision final winner? What do you actually get out of it? And there must be, you know, if you talk about the economics of it, obviously they host this, they'll be the host city next year. But what benefits do they get from winning?
Well, Phil, if you think about it, Eurovision is watched by 120 million or more Europeans. And even in countries that take the event a little bit more cynically, like the UK, there are more than 7.5 million people watching on TV. So it's extremely important economically. And even Malmö, which is quite a small town, is only, I think, the third biggest city in Sweden. I was talking to a cab driver that said he never seen the city so busy. So, of course, it brings a lot of money to the city, a lot of attention. I'm sure a lot of people, when they think about Sweden, they will think about Malmö, not only Stockholm.
And what's quite interesting about this particular Eurovision is, in the past, we've heard so much about block voting and how politically charged the contest is. But that didn't seem as prominent this year.
Not really. And you know, they were trying to fix this problem because now the voting is divided 50% by the public and 50% by the jury. And if you look at the results, there was absolutely no block. Of course, you know, Cyprus will always vote for Greece and vice versa, you know, but that's kind of common. If you see the top five, there was Denmark, Azerbaijan, Ukraine, Norway, quite a mixture of Eastern and Western European countries. So if the country didn't do well, it's because they have to train better for next year, I think.
Well, Fernando, I've been saying all of last week that I've never seen you so excited and happy over this. But of course, we have unfortunately come to the end of Eurovision for this year. But we've got lots to look forward to for next year, that's for sure.
Absolutely. I'll see you in Denmark.
Excellent.
Year.
Thanks very much, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We'll be back right after this very short break with a roundup of the stories from Istanbul.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest edition we discuss the future of Italian design with Moroso and Cassina. We attend the Pratt Institute's latest fashion showcase and New York's newest design fair, Collective One. And we talk fetishism and cushions with Dutch design guru Lee Edelcourt.
I believe that for the luxury industry, the fetishization of their world is imminent and very important, actually.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 13:39 in Shanghai, 8:39 in Lagos and 2:39 in Denver. Well, it's time now to head over to Turkey to find out what's making the news there, from the fallout over the Reyhanlı bombing, a credit rating upgrade and divisions within parliament. Joining us on the line from Istanbul is Caleb Lauer. Thanks very much for joining us, Caleb. Let's hear more about the fallout from this bombing.
Yeah, as many of your listeners will know, there was a massive bomb in Turkey on the 11th of May in Reyhanlı, in the southern province of Hatay in Turkey, which borders Syria. More than 50 people were killed, hundreds were wounded, and the whole sort of commercial residential district was destroyed. It was a tragic attack. And beyond the human tragedy, there are about three things that make this attack something important to understand. The first is it shows how vulnerable Turkey is to the civil war in Turkey and how risky its Syrian policy is. The Turkish-Syrian border has become very, very porous with refugees flowing into Turkey and back into Syria, rebels flowing into Syria, weapons, goods, all kinds of things are able to move quite easily. And now we see that so too can car bombs. There was another car bomb in February, but it blew up at the border gate. This is the first car bomb or bomb that we've seen blow up inside Turkey. And the thing is that among all the major players, Russia, Iran, Israel, the USA, the other neighbors in the region, Turkey is the only country, and in particular Prime Minister Erdogan, is the only statesman that has been sort of actively and openly working for and calling for the downfall of Assad. But Assad, as everybody knows, is still there. And so the current situation, you know, civil war, Assad's still there, rebels operating from Turkish soil and with support of Turkey. This is a terrible situation, but it's the best that Turkey and Erdogan has been able to achieve. And this really makes Turkey a target, and because, you know, his number one enemy, so to speak, is still in power in Damascus.
Well, you mentioned there, Caleb, Erdogan working or actively courting for the downfall of Assad, but over the weekend in Reyhanlı, there were anti-government protests, many people angry at Ankara and specifically Prime Minister Erdogan for not doing more in terms of retaliating for this attack, which of course has been linked to intelligence officials within the Syrian regime.
Right. They've been protesting all over, and in Istanbul as well. There was a massive protest last week that was put down by tear gas and water cannons. And basically, the protests are blaming the government for, you know, inviting these types of attacks through its policy. You know, this is a real bad situation for Erdogan in terms of his domestic standing, but also for Turkey's aspirations to be a regional leader. You know, Erdogan announced, I believe it was yesterday, that in 2014 we could be looking at three national votes, local elections across the country, a vote for the president, which Erdogan would presumably the number one candidate, and a referendum on the new constitution. These types of protests and this sort of risk to his standing domestically vis-a-vis Syria is going to be a real problem and something very, very important to watch.
And there has been also a significant shift in the Turkish economy. The credit rating upgrade, which will make the country's bonds eligible to a greater number of investment funds. How significant is that in their economic story?
It is and it isn't. You know, after Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008, there was a real sort of awareness that these credit rating agencies were not particularly on the ball with regards to many of their clients, the assets and the bonds and things that they rated. But still, 5 years later, 6 years later, these credit rating agencies still are part of the mechanisms by which international finance and funds flow. So the fact that Turkey has got its second investment grade, this time from Moody's, which put Turkey up to a Baa3 rating, which is the lowest of its investment grades, followed from Fitch last year, and we're still waiting for S&P. But this will, in fact, be significant, that it will release a lot of institutional funds, things like pension plans, et cetera, that will be able to invest in Turkey. And this is good news for the stock exchange here. Turkey has plans to make Istanbul the finance center of the region. And despite the fact that the stock exchange has been hitting record highs lately, it's still quite a shallow capital market here. And as many people know, Turkey has massive infrastructure plans that will need to be funded. And to fund those, Turkish companies will have to be borrowing. And this rating upgrade will make that much easier.
And good news out of there for Turkey. The growth rate, roughly around 9% until it slowed a bit sharply last year. But let's move on to another topic, which is getting some headlines there in Istanbul. Divisions within the main opposition party in the Turkish parliament.
Yes, this is a very interesting story to watch because it is about the main opposition party in the Turkish parliament, which is the Cumhuriyet Halk Partisi, which is the People's Republican Party. This is sort of one of the most venerable Turkish parties. It's the Kemalist party that claims to be defending the legacy of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, which was the founder of Turkey. But within the party, I should say that many people in Turkey blame the CHP for the AK Party's power, in the sense that the AK Party, Erdogan's party, has lots and lots of support, obviously with a 50% voter election rate last election. But still, that is not decreased at all by the fact that the CHP has no real policies. They have no real plan. They don't offer anything except a constant stream of no's to everything the AK Party does. And that has sort of reflected back into the party that, and you start to see these divisions. Is the party, on the one hand, a Kemalist, statist, sort of unitary, militaristic party, or is it a leftist, progressive, Western-oriented, secular party? And In the last sort of 6 months, we've seen real divisions between these two groups, which will most likely lead to a split of the party and the end of, like I say, one of the most sort of storied parties in political history.
Yeah, clearly a critical time there. Well, Caleb Lauer in Istanbul, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 9:46. If you are in Rome, it's 8:46 here in London. Now, this week on Culture, Robert Bound is taking a look at the world of advertising. He'll be asking what makes a good commercial, how are global campaigns altered for an Iranian audience, and what's the most eye-catching way to make your car listing on Craigslist go viral?
Well, all those questions will be answered on the show, but for this preview, we're off to South Africa, where last year over 300 international commercials were produced, most of them in the beautiful city of Cape Town. Leonie March reports on the attraction and the challenges of the commercial film industry in South Africa and the nation's rising star, Durban.
Give me two eyeballs at the third one, please.
Preparations are underway for a commercial shoot taking place just half an hour drive from Cape Town. The scenery is stunning. Vineyards bask in the soft morning sun, the sky cloudless blue, a mountain range far on the horizon. A large white tent has been pitched for the film crew, the provincial road has been closed to the public, everyone on the set is rushing to start without delay. Philip Key keeps us calm in this buzz of activity. He's one of the pioneers in South Africa's commercial film industry. In 1989, he founded Moonlighting, one of the first commercial production services in the country. Many of his clients are international advertisers. Today is no exception.
It's quite an ambitious shoot. It's running over 8 shooting days and, you know, looking for various different locations, which is one of the reasons that they're here, because in Cape Town we do have a lot of very diverse locations within a limited amount of space. So you can get from one, you can be shooting a mountain in the morning, on the beach in the afternoon, in the city in the evening. So, you know, when we get shoots that require a lot of multiple locations, South Africa's, and particularly Cape Town's, often a good choice.
Thank you. If you're not on, you're not coming with. Let's go.
International advertisers just love Cape Town. 75% of the commercials produced in the so-called Mother City are for the global market, many for the UK. A lot of locations have got a familiar Mediterranean feel. Sandy beaches, rugged mountains, scenic roads and state-of-the-art mansions. It's comfortable to work here. Everything is close, the film infrastructure well developed, skilled crews always available. For Philip Key, this is crucial to stay competitive in the industry.
Commercials are very quick. You know, somebody's going to call you and say they want you to do a budget estimate, and you'll do that maybe in a couple of hours, maybe in a day. And they could confirm next week and they're there the week after, and they shoot for a couple of days and they go home. So it requires a big infrastructure that's got to be on standby for them all the time.
Johannesburg, South Africa's largest city and economic center, offers a similar film infrastructure to Cape Town, but only 25% of the commercials here are produced for the international market. But advertisers from abroad are starting to realize its potential. Bobby M is executive officer of the Commercial Producers Association.
Johannesburg is quite popular as well, particularly for kind of inner city, deconstructed, sort of urbanized environments. The city's got a very nice edge to it. So we find many of the people who want to come and look for that particular type of location do come to Johannesburg.
South Africa in general remains a very popular destination, not just because of its diversity of locations. When it's winter in the Northern Hemisphere, it's summer in South Africa. The days are long and light, you can film up to 14 hours a day. Crews are cheaper to hire, production costs lower, and the foreign exchange rate is favorable to clients from Europe or the States. But over the last 10 years, the industry has seen the rise of new competitive locations, especially in South America. To remain attractive to advertisers, even as an established city, Cape Town scrapped location fees a while ago. Other emerging destinations within South Africa, like the subtropical city of Durban, are going even further to gain business. Tony Monti is CEO of the Durban Film Office.
The city of Durban, basically for the last 10 years, has offered its services free to productions. So the use of the Metro Police, the use of the disaster management when you arrive here, there's a whole team of city officials that are really working for you and working for you free of charge. Of course, we are hard at work building an indigenous film industry. That's very important to us. But the commercials industry in particular is very important to us because this really becomes the bread and butter of the industry, especially for the local crew, for the technicians, for the local service providers, so that they have an understanding of the industry. So in fact, the commercials industry is very important to us in Durban.
In Cape Town, the revenues from international commercial productions have helped to create a solid film infrastructure and boost employment. But that doesn't mean everyone can just sit back and relax, Bobby M. from the Commercial Producers Association tells me.
What we've seen in the last few years is obviously the huge, move in technology away from film and towards digital. And that's proving very challenging just in terms of keeping up. Our producers are speaking all the time about the latest gear that's coming into the country and how it becomes obsolete in a very short space of time. So there's a perpetual need to obviously re-gear and also to upskill all the crew who are actually available. But I think that's an international trend, and I think it's something that everybody's experiencing at the moment.
With other locations facing similar challenges surrounding costs and skills, South Africa remains one of the favorite destinations of global advertisers, a place on the top which the country is actively defending. For Monocle in South Africa, I'm Leonie March.
And you can hear the whole of our advertising special edition of Culture tonight at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24.
But now it is time for a flick through this morning's British front pages. Joining us now in the studio is Monocle's lovely news editor, Tom Edwards. Tom, thanks for coming into the studio.
Phil, it's an absolute pleasure. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Well, before we get into some of those front pages, we've just got to briefly touch on one topic, which I know is very dear to your heart. Now, I'm not a football fan, but I hear you had some very bad news over the weekend.
Phil, I've come in. It's the start of a new week. I want to look ahead. I want to be positive. And you're sitting there with your sweatshirt with your big H on it.
Yeah, I apologise for that passive-aggressive attack.
It's unbelievable,
your team.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I hear you're also you've lost a bet as well to a fellow Monocle producer, Alad John.
10 English pounds. Oof. English pounds, Alad here. Not Welsh. We have our proper currency in this country.
Well, let's have a look at what some of the front pages this morning. What's grabbed your attention?
Well, I thought there was an interesting piece on the front of the Independent, British Businesses, colon, we need to stay in the EU. Richard Branson and Martin Sorrell among a number of high-profile signatories on a letter to the paper complaining about Eurosceptics. And it's interesting, we're looking at the sort of rise of UKIP, Tories, as usual, riven by infighting over the European question. Some of their leading key frontline sort of ministers and suggesting that they would vote to leave the EU if there were a referendum tomorrow. These business leaders are saying, look, this is not good enough. We're not getting the pro-European message out there. Not just pro-European, but pro-business. They suggest that Eurosceptic MPs are putting politics before economics and abandoning the national interest. So people like Richard Branson, Martin Sorrell, a number of other high-profile people, Roger Carr, who's the chairman of Centrica, the big energy company. And I just think it's interesting that, you know, that are the Tories now risking losing some of their big business backers if they maintain this kind of heavily Eurosceptic position, and it's difficult to know where this madness will end on this question.
Because Branson's public profile is huge in terms of both the attention he attracts domestically and across the world, really. So if Cameron is looks set to oppose both his and Sorrell's aims and views, it's potentially damaging and attracting big business for him.
Definitely. And if you think about, I mean, obviously the Virgin Group, very international. Martin Sorrell probably even more so with WPP. I think it's the world's biggest sort of marketing company. They can't afford to have these people suggesting that they're putting politics first. And yet at the same time, Cameron seems rather hamstrung, so I don't actually know what he can do about it. It just is more damage, and it'll be more damage limitation for him as this term of office continues.
And Tom, another story which has grabbed your attention, perhaps with the a bit of a catchy headline, I hear.
Well, yeah, this is in the Daily Telegraph. Things turn Nazi again. See what they've done there. At War Year celebration. I mean, in some ways, this is quite distasteful. There's a 40-star weekend. People descend on the West Yorkshire town of Haworth to sort of commemorate the Dambusters raid, various kind of 40s nostalgia. And a bunch of the people who arrive, despite instructions to the contrary and lots of signs that are up in the village, arrive in German uniforms, SS uniforms. Not popular, and as some of the more historically minded people have pointed out, inaccurate, because there weren't any SS people in Yorkshire at that stage, at least not in their full Nazi regalia. And it's just quite interesting that, I just wonder, Phil, what would possess someone to turn up in that outfit? They're wearing, you know, the leather coats, the eagle emblems, the whole caper.
It's a bit random.
Why do they even have those?
It's a bit odd, isn't it?
It's certainly a little odd.
Especially because it looks like from the picture some of these individuals are quite elderly as well. So they may have actually been around during the war.
Very possibly. And so you'd think that they would have, memories of the, let's say, more unfortunate aspects
tougher
of this
times,
time.
Perhaps.
But I think it's quite interesting that you've got this kind of town, which is, of course, famous from the likes of the sort of Bronte sisters, all this kind of thing. Rather unfortunate if you choose to arrive dressed up as a member of Himmler's death squad.
Yes, and their defence that it's historically accurate, of course, you picked up on the irony there. Also defending this, something that happens every year, and they say raises money for Help for Heroes. But
it's probably, is it dirty money now? I'm sure they'll be grateful for the £25,000, not inconsiderable sum. But it's tainted in some way, I would put it to them.
It certainly cast a shadow somewhere.
And Tom, we have time very quickly for just one more story. Give it to us.
Well, let's look at the Times of London. Harvey Weinstein, the big character, literally, metaphorically, from the world of film. He's bemoaning the fact that there are no British films in competition at the Cannes Film Festival this year. Do you know what he said, Phil? He said, it sucks.
That's put simply, huh?
He's not happy about it. He's vowed that there'll be British contenders next year. I'm not quite sure why Harvey's so worried about this.
You Brits, you have so many films that are always at the top of the charts, so I don't know what other complaining is about. But unfortunately, Tom, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks for having a look through the front pages with us. Thanks to our producers Alan John and Thomas Lewis, our researchers Annabelle Bly and Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager Chris Fitch. Up after the news is The Entrepreneurs. I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds tomorrow at the same time for Midori House. But from me, Phil Hahn,
and me, Cordelia Lynch,
it's bye-bye.
Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.